This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have with us a person whom we've talked to on the telephone, as I recall, 7 years ago when she picked up an honor, and she was also a Purdue University Northwest staff member, faculty member. And she's back with us now to talk about the latest honor that she and 400, is it, were that many people on the team?
And we're, yeah, talking, that's correct.
Wow. Niti Parashar is a physics professor. In fact, she is actually in charge of a section of the physics department on the Hammond campus. And she and others have been working together and have picked up an award for their work on, a physics area, which is, well, maybe for us lay people, it's just as complex and maybe perplexing as the Higgs boson, which was the last award for being on the research team that you picked up. Tell us a little bit about this latest award that you recently picked up and going all the way to Belgium to receive it.
Right. So the European Physical Society awarded the 2019 Particle Physics and High Energy Physics Award to two collaborations. So this is given every 2 years, either to individuals or a group of experiments that have done something very fundamental and of relevance in the field. So this prize specifically was given to the two collaborations or the two detectors, namely CDF, Collider Detector at Fermilab, and D0, of which we are members of at PNW. So these two collaborations received the award for the discovery of the top quark and its detailed measurements of its properties.
We've heard about quarks before. In fact, I think maybe several other scientists have mentioned their works in the past. Explain, if you will, what a quark is and how it does happen to be so important to trying to figure out the origin of the universe.
So everything is related to the genesis of how the universe came into being. Okay, its cosmic structure, what makes it up, what holds it together. So in particle physics, those are actually some of the basic questions we are trying to address. And quarks, in general, are a group of fundamental particles that make up the matter that surrounds us everywhere. So top quark is very unique because it's the heaviest of the six and was very difficult to find in the data because its mass of 173 giga electron volts actually resides at the electroweak scale. So having to produce those kinds of energies at the accelerators was a Herculean task to be able to detect this.
Is this something that that the accelerator, the setup at that Fermilab over in Illinois is perhaps best capable of doing, or did they have to do some modification even to make it be able to detect?
Sure. So the top quark itself was discovered in 1995, and this was through the first set of data taken called Run 1. Then the pieces of detectors as well as the accelerator were upgraded so we could cope up with higher energy, higher luminosity, and so forth. So it was in the second run, which started in 2001 and went all the way up to 2011. That we were actually able to study the top quark in details. And the relevance of this is extremely important because it helps us to really gauge what is happening at the electroweak scale, which is the basis and the bread and butter of how particles acquire their mass and how they come into their very existence.
Now, since you were in charge of the high energy physics program at Purdue University Northwest in the Hammond campus, how do you as a professor get to apply what you have in turn along with your colleagues in getting the award, get to be able to turn over someday, at least for students to be able to take a look at to use in their studies in physics and in any research they may learn to do?
So as a professor, I think the most exhilarating part for me is when I see students getting excited about what we do. And in my opinion, I think what we can transfer to our students is really our own excitement about the work we do. So research in itself, whether it's high energy physics or any other area, so to say, if we can involve our students, then they are going beyond the pedagogy of the classroom where they are learning the traditional stuff. stuff. But then when they get exposed to the research opportunities, then they have their own aha moments of learning things and associating the concepts they may have learned in classroom to what they're actually seeing.
Now, I know you take advantage of the fact that, Batavia, Illinois, is not all that far away from Hammond, Indiana, and you have a chance to take students from your classes over to the Fermi Lab. What do they get to see when they actually go over there? Do they get to see the accelerator, and what do they get to take away from that to bring back and talk about in class?
So they do get to see the accelerator, except it's not operational anymore. It stopped data taking in 2011. Mm-hmm. But they get to see the academic life. They get to see the control rooms. They get to see the main control room, because there are several other experiments being conducted at the laboratory, neutrino being the main emphasis of the lab at the moment. Then they get to see the upgrade detector work that's being done in different areas for the other experiments, such as the Large Hadron Collider, where we at PNW are also members of. So our students, postdocs, go learn that and bring back what they have learned to really understand why we are doing what we are doing is the focus of the research. And again, this boils down to the existence of universe as it is. So it's a pure science research area, which is the top of excitement, and putting PNW on this global map of discoveries, I think they got a little glimpse of what scientists do in real life.
It's almost like one of these books that you would see in the library, you know. What does a scientist do, you know? Well, it goes much more beyond that, certainly, but it gives you an idea, I suppose. One of the opportunities I know that you have as a professor at Purdue Northwest is to be able to take, besides taking students over to Fermilab and see the operations and learn a bit more that they can use in their classes and hopefully their careers, you've had a chance to take them also to CERN. And we're referring to the acronym, which refers to a big organization in Switzerland.
Right. So CERN stands for the English acronym expansion is European Organization for Nuclear Research. So we are very fortunate and unique in the sense that we get funded by, or federally funded, I should say, by National Science Foundation. So that support allows also for us to take our students to the laboratory in Switzerland at CERN. So they stay there for the summer. They get exposed to the academic life. They work in the laboratories. They interact with elite scientists from all over the world, because these are all international collaborations. And obviously, when they come back, they can relate the theory that they have learned to the real-world hands-on experience that they get.
The last time that you picked up an award for what you had done as part of the Purdue University Northwest faculty in the physics department, and we've had a chance to mention it at the outset of our conversation to talk with you about, is the other awards that you picked up for the other research that you had done with the team that was looking into the Higgs boson. For people that are not familiar with the Higgs boson, what is a Higgs boson, and how does that all fit in together with what you have picked up your latest research award for?
So the Standard Model is our Bible for particle physics and our bread and butter. This was finding the Higgs was the last missing piece of the model, and it's very basic in the sense that it allowed for us to understand how the origin of mass came into being. Why is the electron so much lighter, which is also a fundamental particle, and the top quark is so heavy? We had some theoretical clues, but we had no experimental evidence to substantiate that knowledge. So therefore, finding the Higgs boson in the data was very crucial. This could not have been done at Fermilab because of the energies that we were operating at. However, within 6 months of data taking at CERN, we did it. So finding that Higgs boson allowed us once again to understand the origin of mass. Again, a very intrinsic but a very fundamental quantity of all these subatomic particles that exist out there.
What is, the next project, or is this a continuing project that you and the researchers are going to be going on, besides going here from the boson, going into the latest research here into quarks, and what you picked up the latest award for? What is next in the I guess, in the scientific research field, to continue on the research?
So a couple of things we are focusing on. For one, we don't know whether the Higgs that we have found, is it the Higgs, or there are multiple of them that exist. So there are models beyond Standard Model that have postulated the existence of different types of Higgs. So we are working on that. And then we also are very heavily involved in the upgrade of detectors. Currently, the accelerator at CERN, it's on the, in the shutdown mode, meaning to be able to cope up with the higher luminosities, we need to make sure our detectors are smart. So we are working on that at Fermilab as well as at Cornell. So our students, our postdocs, we are all involved in that research at the moment.
Are we finding that much more of this research has to be taken to the next level because these accelerators, like the one in Batavia, and then you mentioned the one in CERN, are being shut down or have been shut down?
So there is one, shutdown can have several connotations here. Yeah. So when I say Fermilab accelerator shutdown, means it's not operational anymore. So there's it's not going to have subatomic particles, the protons and its antimatter, the antiproton, collide anymore. It is being used for different experiments. So collider physics won't be done at Fermilab anymore. However, at CERN, when we say it's in shutdown mode, it means this is a lull period where we are not doing anything, we are not taking data, but we are improving and upgrading our different components of the detector so it's ready to accept data with great efficiency when we crank it up again.
So it sounds like it's more on standby. At least the CERN accelerator is more of in a standby mode rather than actually being shut down then.
So. That's a good way to put it.
What is going to be one of the topics that you happen to bring up? And, of course, you have obviously this information that you can present in the classes that students at Purdue Northwest are going to be able to take advantage of this coming school year. What other programs within the physics department are you and your colleagues going to be able to work on?
So education and outreach is very important to me besides this core research. So we have a QuarkNet Center wherein we support high school teachers and students in the area and train them every year as well as once in the spring semester. We have a full one-day workshop. So that part to me is very crucial because giving back to community and trying to let our students in the area actually know what we are doing, because this is a facility right in your backyard with Research One capability. I'm not sure everybody gets the hang of it. So through this center, we are able to actually reach out to high schools in the area, talk to them, have their teachers come and train in the area of particle physics at Fermilab, at CERN. So they travel everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that exposure and opportunity in itself is it presents itself with tremendous excitement. Then they take that knowledge back to their students in the classroom, and the hope is they would come and study physics at the university and eventually work at these laboratories.
It's interesting that we have so many high schools that are involved in the process as well. We have so many around here in Northwest Indiana that obviously are very interested and have very good, very strong physics departments, and they have students that are very interested. They're just as curious now as they were, would you say, maybe 10, 15 years ago?
I think the discovery of the Higgs has really promoted that excitement and interest in the public, in the non-scientific community, a little bit more than what we had before. But these discoveries don't come around every day. So when it happens, I think it catches the attention. And certainly the students, the younger generation, is all excited about sciences and physics in particular ever since.
Well, Professor Parashar, thank you for spending time with us here on Lakeshore Public Radio to talk about some of the information behind the announcement of the award that's been handed out to you and the 400 or so research colleagues that have gotten this latest award, which has been presented by the European Physical Society. The 2019 High Energy and Particle Physics Prize is what it's called, and Professor Parashar from The Hammond campus in Northwest Indiana is when her team have been working, or her members, other members of the team all together have been working on this project for some time. Thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, and we're hoping that maybe this will spur on the interest, if it hasn't already, into certainly into particle physics, and looking for the next things that we can discover in the origin of the universe, but also in turn help spur students along to decide to take up this opportunity to learn and to carry on the research as well in the future. Thanks for being by today.
Thank you so much. Guys, go and study physics at PNW.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Ivy Tech Community College is teaming up with a Northwest Indiana-based business and also some school organizations as well, too, that in turn is going to help provide some opportunities for some in-demand, high-wage manufacturing jobs. And with us to talk about it, we have Caleb Westberg. He's the director of K-12 initiatives for Ivy Tech Community College, which is based in Gary. And Caleb, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about the initiative that has been set up through Ivy Tech Community College and the River Forest Community Schools to involve a well-involved company that does a lot of area work for businesses and industry, Praxair.
I have to say, you know, we're incredibly grateful to have such great partners. And none of this work would be possible without both Praxair and River Forest and the great initiative that they've shown. We have come to the table together and have been working really almost for the last year now to get this program up and going. It's a part of Praxair's skills pipeline, and also River Forest's initiatives to help increase college and career attainment levels. And, of course, Ivy Tech's mission here is interested in making sure that we can continue to earn more and help students earn more college-level certifications and completions and degrees. So, you know, we kind of have a nice synergy of alignment here with all of our goals. And basically what we've done is developed a pipeline that allows students who are still in high school to start doing some college coursework in order to earn a degree in process operations, with the goal of having more students in Northwest Indiana know about advanced manufacturing and process operations technology.
This is something I know that is certainly very much in demand, not only here in Northwest Indiana, but across the entire state of Indiana. And Governor Eric Holcomb has been pushing very hard for programs like this to get people prepared for these jobs of the 21st century, in particular people that need the extra training. Maybe they've been working in another career. They find that career is not even fulfilling, or maybe it's actually ended perhaps because of whatever reason it may be, and they need to find a new career. This is one opportunity they have to learn what they need to learn, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, that's partially how this program is funded and how we actually ended up working with this particular pathway. Not only is this an area that a lot of local companies like Praxair, BP, ArcelorMittal, et cetera, that they need these kinds of qualified employees, and there is a labor shortage in terms of skilled workers who know how to do things like process operations and be production technicians. But the governor's office, Governor Holcomb, had set aside funding through a Next Level Jobs program. And the process ops program that we have at the college is funded or helps, is funded in part by Next Level Jobs. And so through a combination of Governor Holcomb's initiative as well as Praxair and their generous donation, we're able to actually make sure that this program is entirely free to students.
Now, I understand that River Forest is very much involved in bringing in students from all over the region almost, isn't it? Not only within their own particular school district, but others around the area. Which other school districts or communities are going to be involved in this project?
True, yeah. They actually have a lot of students throughout the region that attend their school, such as Valparaiso. They've got students from Gary, of course, Hobart, East Chicago, Whiting, all over.
What kind of work will these students be able to do once they're getting their technical certificates in process operations? What areas will Praxair likely be able to put these folks to work?
Right. Yeah, so students are going to learn about things like fluid power systems. They're going to get hands-on lab work. And our objective is to have everyone qualified to enter the workforce after they finish. One of the jobs that they would be qualified to take up as soon as they finish with us is to be production technicians. And this is a critical job for many companies like Praxair that need some work in terms of their fluid power systems. You know, a lot of the work that we do here in the region in advanced manufacturing, we don't have the kind of labor market that has folks with enough background and certifications in advanced manufacturing. So one of the classes that we have in the program helps students earn what we call their MSSC certifications, which the MSSC is a third-party organization that actually credentials students who earn their certifications with manufacturing skills. And so production technician is one of those areas. But, of course, one of the nice things is that most of the companies that hire these students actually pay for them to continue on in their education to get a bachelor's degree or beyond if that's of interest.
Now, we've noticed that there have been some informational sessions already held here in Northwest Indiana to let students and parents know about this program. And the program is going to get started very soon, will it not, here this month even?
Yeah, actually, that's a great point. We actually had an information session last night, and we have one tomorrow at 1 o'clock, I believe. So we'd love to have more folks attend that. It'll be held at River Forest tomorrow at 1. And it's a parent and student information meeting, and we have classes starting August 26th. That's our first day of classes. This will be taking place at our East Chicago location, which is where we have all the process operations equipment. Mm-hmm. And we're very excited to have the students start with us.
Now, if anybody is interested, not only students, but parents would like to be able to pass along more information to their students about what Praxair and what River Forest is involved with, along with Ivy Tech, how can they find out more now?
I would encourage folks to go to the information session tomorrow at 1 o'clock at River Forest, or they can also contact us directly.
We've been talking with Caleb Westberg. He is the director of K-12 initiatives for Ivy Tech Community College, based in here in Northwest Indiana in Gary. And we've been talking about the collaborative that Praxair, Ivy Tech, and the River Forest Community Schools worked out together to get some additional training to high school students about manufacturing opportunities that will certainly, as we mentioned, give opportunities for jobs in the 21st century. And Caleb, thank you for joining us today about this. The latest escalation in the trade war with China is driving uncertainty for many Hoosier businesses. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports that one Indiana trade group is working to help companies find some stability in new markets.
The trade war between the U.S. and China has continued to intensify more than a year after the Trump administration imposed the first round of tariffs. Greg Zeller is chairman of the World Trade Center of Indianapolis. He says instead of cutting back in the face of growing uncertainty, his organization is working with companies to find alternative markets outside of China.
At a time when they're somewhat nervous about the future, but to find ways to expand their global accessing of markets and the accessing of supplies.
Indiana exports more than $3 billion worth of goods and services to China, according to the U.S.-China Business Council. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
The National Federation of the Blind filed a lawsuit on Tuesday against the state agency that handles Medicaid benefits. The complaint alleges that the Family and Social Services Administration violated the rights of two blind plaintiffs. We find out more in this from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Carter Barrett.
The suit alleges the state agency has committed systemic violations against its blind clients. Plaintiffs Christopher Meyer and Sarah Meyer say they repeatedly asked the FSSA for Braille or electronic documents readable via special software, but they were told the agency didn't have the capacity to provide those documents, which are needed to enroll for benefits. The case's managing attorney, Tom Krishan, says that violates the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990.
And to have to rely on a sighted individual to be able to read them their mail and their communications related to their health insurance is inappropriate.
As a result, the lawsuit says the plaintiffs missed filing deadlines and lost health coverage. When asked for a response, the state agency said it doesn't comment on pending litigation. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Carter Barrett.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and with us we have now Brian Howie, who's the fellow who is behind the Howie Politics Indiana online newsletter that's out there, and he follows through, of course, on information almost every single day on the website, howiepolitics.com, to talk about politics not only in Indiana, but around the nation and sometimes even around the world. And it seems like lately, though, Brian, it's pretty much concentrated to within the 50 states, is it not?
Well, yeah, although, you know, the Iranians are confiscating a tanker, an oil tanker here.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, the Hormuz Straits. Maybe we should include them,
too. We do have the invasion.
Yeah.
We got the invasion coming in from Central America.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things. That's one of the things I wanted you to talk about. In fact, the atomic, which is the almost weekday power lunch talking points newsletter that goes out. That's on Howie Politics Indiana. Goes into more detail. You come up with some interesting talking points based on the news, based on what's been said by many people, and in particular our chief executive in Washington D.C., who I guess now is actually he's on the road, isn't he? He's supposed to be visiting El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, much to the chagrin, I understand, of some folks in both cities.
Well, he's in Dayton right now. I think he's at a medical center visiting people who, I think, 26 people were wounded. 9 were killed late Saturday night in Dayton. So he's there. Just had Fox News on here a little bit ago, and they're waiting. Paying officials to make remarks, and then he gets on Air Force One and heads down to El Paso. There's been some demonstrations in both places, but you know, there's been enough local officials who say it's appropriate for the president to be there. The problem for President Trump is, you know, he has been using what I can call incendiary rhetoric, describing Latinos. And citing the invasion, and of course you've got this shooter down in El Paso, who you know cites the invasion for his reason to shoot up at Walmart, and so that's the problem. It comes under the category, you know, words have consequences.
Mm-hmm. We know that the job description for being president of the United States is, I guess, officially very small, very short, I should say. And one of the, I guess, one of the collateral jobs that you have on the side is to become what is referred to by many as the consoler in chief. And there's
right.
not question about whether he's actually become that.
Well, you know, we'll have to see. I mean, a lot of people thought that the statement that he made in a brief national press conference on Monday was kind of like rote, and there are a lot of commentators now are saying there's teleprompter Trump who will, you know, read what staff puts in front of him, and then there's Twitter Trump, and that's where you get the, you know, what he's really thinking and seeing. And so all eyes have been on the Twitter account lately to see if he backtracks, because to tell you the truth, I never know when to believe the guy and when not to. You know, he'll come out and say one thing. He was talking about, you know, background checks and everything, and then when he gave the speech Monday morning, he didn't mention it. And so you don't know kind of where he's at. The goalposts are always kind of moving with him.
One of the other items that you had in one of the recent, the atomic columns, I guess, for sort of another way to put it, talks about the reaction from our delegation on Capitol Hill to what has happened and to some of the comments that have been made. What do our senators have to say about it?
Well, first of all, we've kind of gotten our delegation to stop using the phrase thoughts and prayers after each of the atrocities that we've had. We've had 22 mass shootings so far this year in the United States. Channel 13, WTHR, kind of pulled the delegation a couple days ago,
mm-hmm.
and while they did get a few, you know, comments about, you know, thinking about the families and we need to do something, there wasn't a lot of specifics. Senator Braun made some comments in Fort Wayne yesterday, in which he is talking about, you know, common sense solutions and passing laws that can actually be enforced. So I'm kind of, for the delegation, I'm kind of watching Senator Braun. He seems to be kind of charting his own course, hasn't ruled out, I don't think he's ruled out background checks. So there's an Ohio congressman whose district is Dayton. He's talking about an assault weapons ban. So I'm kind of keeping an eye on Senator Braun, and then you've got Representative Susan Brooks, who's announced she's not seeking re-election, so she's kind of free to do, you know, whatever she wants and not have to worry about political retribution. And then the southwestern Indiana congressman, Larry Bichon, he's a medical doctor, and he's scheduled, I think, 4 town halls in August. it's going to be very interesting to see who turns out, what they have to say down in Southwest Indiana.
Mm-hmm. One of the other topics that you often bring up on the Howie Politics Indiana site that's also available, too, by subscription, and so you can see in much more detail, is the opportunity to learn what the candidates that want to become at least the nominee for the Democratic Party for president in next year's election, I have to say. We've had our series and apparently our continuing series of debates. What is your takeaway from some of the latest conversations, and in particular, everybody seems to be watching, and you have mentioned this before in our previous conversations, keeping an eye on Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah, you know, Pete has raised a lot of money, but he really is kind of fading in the polls. And, you know, after all, you know, two debates and you know, a field of, 22 or three candidates, you know, Joe Biden is kind of right where he was when we kind of began this whole sequence. And I haven't really seen anything that makes me think that he won't get the nomination. Now, having said that, it's a long way. You know, we're more than 6 months away from the Iowa caucus and then the New Hampshire primary, so a lot can happen. I think a key thing in September will be, you know, this third debate sequence. There is the field is going to winnow. We'll probably not have as many candidates, and that will be the opportunity for Mayor Buttigieg to maybe to make some inroads and hope that that Joe Biden falters. But right now, you know, Biden looks pretty strong.
Mm-hmm. Taking a look at some of the candidates on the state level here, as we're talking mainly, of course, a lot this time around in elections, it's the local candidates that are up for review for the cities around the state. What information do you get in from your contacts around that you put together for your reports that go out on Howie Politics Indiana about how the mayor races are doing around Indiana and Northwest Indiana for that matter too?
Yeah, there don't seem to be many, you know, really competitive mayoral races. We've got a couple of open seats in Valparaiso and Portage. I'm not getting the sense that if any of them changes party, maybe the Portage seat, but it's kind of still early. I haven't seen a lot of coverage mm-hmm. of mayor races. What I'm kind of focusing on is the gubernatorial race, and I sat down with Dr. Woody Myers yesterday. He's the Democrat, former state health commissioner. He was also health commissioner in New York City, and he had some very interesting things to say, so I'll have a full interview with Dr. Myers. In tomorrow's Howie Politics. I've kind of kept in touch with Senator Melton's people. He doesn't appear to be ready to jump in or out. I'm not sure where he's at. He doesn't have an exploratory committee for governor, and he's holding these town halls with the Republican Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick. But I've been told that he's not likely to make a decision until sometime this fall. And then we have the Indianapolis State Rep. Carly Macer, who has also talked about getting in. My sense is, I think, you know, Woody Myers is wealthy, has worked on the Indiana Democratic Party Victory Committee, and I think he's going to be able to raise a lot of money. So I have to put a money bet. I think we're probably going to see a race between Woody Myers and Governor Holcomb
mm-hmm.
In November of 2020.
When you talk about the Governor Holcomb, he's a bit kind of kept quiet in a way. He's not certainly had much to say in particular about the latest incidents with the mass shootings, although I know he did have some comments to Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith about that not long after everything happened or came out earlier this week. But do you see that Governor Holcomb is just kind of, I hate to say coasting along, but he certainly doesn't seem to be pushing his campaign very far, is he?
Well, you know, they did had their big rollout in mid July. You know, drew a couple thousand people. It was pretty well attended. And then he's hit the road. He's done a number of events around the state. So I think he's doing a lot of county fairs. Maybe at the Indiana State Fair. So he has been pretty active. It's going to be interesting to see how Woody Myers gets out and starts moving around the state. A lot of people don't know him. His name ID has to be, you know, probably below 5%. He ran
for the 7th Congressional District in a caucus back in 2008 after Julia Carson died. That's the only time he's run for office. So I'm sure his name ID is not very high at all. And Governor Holcomb, obviously, you know, his name ID is, you know, close to 80%, I think. You know, the governor's sitting on $7 million. He's got supermajorities in the General Assembly. It's going to be real tough for him to be defeated. But you got to play the game, and you never know what's going to happen with President Trump. In 2016, we thought there was going to be a tidal wave in favor of the Democrats, and in this state, it reversed itself and turned into a tsunami for the Republicans. So that's why we have the election.
Do you think that the problems that surround Attorney General Curtis Hill will come up again? We know that we're just kind of going through the legal process right now, aren't we?
Yeah, there's a Supreme Court review of his legal standing, and I believe a report on that will be made in October. And I guess there's one scenario where if the Supreme Court could pull his law license, then he would not be eligible to be Attorney General. So we're kind of waiting to see how that turns out. I've had some conversations with the former Congressman Todd Rokita. He's thinking about potentially getting in. There's an attorney from Zionsville who's going to challenge Hill in the convention. And I don't believe the governor's people are going to get involved in trying to defeat Hill at the convention. They saw what happened when Governor Daniels backed Mayor Costas of Valparaiso for the AG's spot a couple cycles back, and he got beat in the convention, kind of an embarrassing thing. So I don't think the governor is going to actively challenge Attorney General Hill.
What do you think is likely, besides whatever may come about here as far as the state Republican Party convention is concerned, for nominees in the months ahead? What else do you happen to see on the Indiana political party front these days? Things have gotten quiet, I think, mainly because the General Assembly finished up its session and the big long session of working on the budget.
You know, I think the biggest race that's emerging right now is the 5th Congressional District, where you have Congresswoman Brooks, who has decided to retire. And we haven't had many Republicans file yet or even form committees. We've had one pastor from Noblesville who's gotten in. And then on the Democratic side, you have former Representative Christina Hale, who is the lieutenant governor nominee. She's gotten in along with the 2018 nominee, Dee Thornton. So, you know, that's kind of the big race right now on the congressional level. We don't have a U.S. Senate race next year, and then we've got the governor's race, and so those are likely going to be the two big races,
yeah.
In 2020.
Well, I guess we all have our hands full just trying to keep track of what happens coming out of the White House these days. And,
yeah.
And for that matter, everything ahead, not only the White House, but Capitol Hill for that matter, too, I suppose. So we know that we're going to see much more that's out there, and you'll be able to put it out there on Howie Politics Indiana. And, Brian, we appreciate you spending some time with us to talk about these matters involving politics, not only in Indiana, but around the nation and elsewhere. And we hope to have you back on again soon.
Excellent. Looking forward to it.
Brian Howie is the editor and publisher of Howie Politics Indiana. This is National Health Center Week, and it's a big deal here in Northwest Indiana. It recognizes a network of community health centers that play a major role in helping provide affordable health care for those folks who otherwise would not have it. North Township Trustee Frank Bervan has issued a proclamation. In fact, he did so yesterday at the Regional Health Clinic in North Hammond on Holman Avenue about this week, and he talked with us about it and also about how important community health centers are here in Northwest Indiana.
The proclamation is basically an awareness of the Mental Health Centers National Week, and most importantly about regional mental health and the contribution that they have made to the community and the township at large. So the facility on Holman Avenue is able to facilitate not only mental health, but medical and dental needs. They do great outreach as far as medical prevention, and they do specifically with my office, we deal with people who have chronic poverty, and very often there are some mental issues that are tied, or mental health issues that are tied to chronic poverty, such as depression, addiction, schizophrenia. Many of those are treatable and can help people become flourishing in their community if they work at it. So what we did is we created a partnership with Regional Mental Health where they come to our office and clients are able to schedule appointments to see a trained therapist and be able to be on the path of overcoming those ailments of mental illness. So I know for a fact that Regional Mental Health, and I work very closely with Amy Lopez, who is a phenomenal engaging director at Regional Mental Health. And the other side of it is they are providing health care to a community on a sliding scale as a federally qualified health center to be able to assist those individuals. So you have all of these components coming together that really contribute to the quality of life. And here in the next couple weeks, I know for a fact that they'll have a full-blown pharmacy, which will be operating out of the home and office, North Hammond facility for Regional Mental Health, and people will be able to go there for medications at a discounted rate because they are a federally qualified health center.
Oh.
So you tie all that in together with the Mental Health Center National Week, and you just recognize what a great job they do and how they are a great community partner and are contributing to the benefits of our community in North Township.
You mentioned a little bit here just a moment ago about some of the issues that get covered here with the help of the Regional Mental Health Center to resolve. What were situations like here when you all got together 5 years ago in North Township to help the center get built there?
Well, they were specifically tied to, addiction, the opioid crisis. They were tied to marijuana, cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
They were tied to all sorts of addictions that people were coming in and they were unable to focus on real life. The other thing that cannot go unnoticed for young, old, middle-aged is past trauma, PTSD. People who have been traumatized by sexual assault, molestation, all of those traumas ferment and they cause the inability to cope or the inability to interact in society because people withdraw and they feel alone. So what Regional Mental Health has done is given people hope. It's given people their ability to work through their problems. And I think as a society, when we recognize through whatever means necessary, when people are going through trauma, that's when they're needing professional help the most. And I think, I've had conversations where, other countries in the world offer mental health and mental health prevention on a regular basis. And we have to lift the stigma of people wanting to see someone from Regional Mental Health. And that's what we're doing together with Regional Mental Health is we're heightening awareness so that there isn't a stigma and that if someone has gone through something that is traumatic and there are triggers for them and they have withdrawn from society, that they reach out and get help. And those are the types of issues that we have focused on at the township. One small example is our No More Secrets campaign, where we went into the schools and we talked about child molestation.
Yes.
And 73 kids came forward. Well, those children who came forward that were going through that absolutely positively needed to be able to talk to therapists in order to get better outcomes or better survivor rates or a better quality of life, and that's what we're working on.
You mentioned about the fact that the North Hammond location there on Holman Avenue is being able to expand, offering up the pharmaceutical help. Do you think that this in turn will help reduce the stigma to people that need help and that they'll feel more comfortable, especially if it's having to go to not only see somebody about the problems, but also to go in and get the medication they need?
Sure. Not only will that help assist with the stigma, but it also assists with accessibility and affordability of the medications. It's not debatable, but all of our medications, if you're not on an insurance plan and if you are on the affordable health care plan, medications are still very expensive on a sliding scale to all individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And medications for depression, medications for schizophrenia, all types of medications like that are costly and expensive, no matter if you have insurance or not. And so this being a federally qualified health center and in pharmacy, they will be able to offer it at a very, very affordable economical rate. So it lifts the stigma and also does the other part, accessibility. It allows people access to the medications that can help them function and get better outcomes and a better quality of life.
Now, you had the opportunity yesterday in issuing the proclamation celebrating National Health Center Week there at the North Hammond location of the regional health clinic. Yesterday, did anybody have any interesting things to say? Certainly speaking, and thank you to the North Township Trustee's Office for working on this.
Well, I thought that what a lot of people don't know when you deal with social work and social networking is the couple things that stick out of my mind is Dr. Day, who's the dentist there, mm-hmm. has a phenomenal spirit and soul. He's had a private practice for 20 years, and now he's working at Regional, where he's not making a lot of money, but what he is doing is he's helping people. So what you need to know is that dentures and missing teeth for homeless people or people with lack of insurance, that is a dream for people because it is so very, very expensive to be able to do that. And Regional Mental Health has a full dental capacity there for x-rays, for extractions. They're soon to have their own lab for dentures and false teeth. And that is something that I know for a fact saves the township an enormous amount of money because of the cooperative effort that we have. Because we'd have to go to a private practicing dentist and pay thousands of dollars for people to get teeth so that they can work, so that they can eat. So that was one thing. And the other aspect of it that I took away was Dr. Gandhi, who is in charge of the medicine of all the physicians and all the clinics. We had a long conversation about preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. So this clinic that is there that works on mental health, works on preventative medicine, works on dental, their focus is to try and lower the amount of people who go to the emergency rooms because that increases our cost for health care. If someone's going to the emergency room for pneumonia, where they could have went to Regional Mental Health when they had a cold or bronchitis, or if they're getting the proper screenings, such as breast cancer screenings, prostate cancer screenings, ovarian cancer screenings, then you're doing preventative medicine. And that type of approach in the community saves us overall economically, if you look at a macro version, of the state paying for the indigent when they're going to hospitals. So that's what I took away from that conversation. And the most important thing is that Amy Lopez, as the director of Regional Mental Health, is there to help change lives. And it is a one-stop, save-all type of location that people should utilize. And it's going to be my job to continue to funnel clients there and make sure the community is aware of Regional Mental Health in North Hammond and in East Chicago and in Maryville because they are a wonderful facility who offers mental health at a phenomenal economical price, if not free, if they're on Medicare.
That is North Township Trustee Frank Mervan. And again, this is a very special week for he and others who are very interested in community health centers, National Health Center Week. Fayette County, which is in eastern Indiana, was once a bustling area with factories that made parts for the auto industry, but now it has a rather grim distinction. It has the highest suicide and drug death rates in the state. Carter Barrett with Side Effects Public Media visited the county seat of Connersville to see what happened and see how the locals are responding.
In one of the circular windows outside Mousy's restaurant, there's a neon open sign that's been turned off. After 65 years in business, this restaurant closed late last year. Marcia Day tells me that this used to be a really popular spot for the factory workers up the street.
So we got a lot of the shop business and a lot of union meetings taking place down there.
Day grew up in Fayette County, in the eastern part of the state. Back then, Connersville was called Little Detroit because of the factories that make car air conditioners and fuel injectors.
I mean, it used to be booming. We have shoe stores, dress shops, department stores downtown. Now we don't have any of those.
As factories closed and downtown declined, some statistics rose. Unemployment, drug use, and suicides. And Day's only son, Ryan, who struggled with depression, died by suicide at 25 amid a breakup with his girlfriend.
When you have a child, you don't think that you're going to bury them first. They're supposed to bury you.
Fayette County's rapid spike in overdose deaths has outpaced state and national numbers, according to data from a University of Chicago research center. Michael Mee is the co-director of the NORC Walsh Center for Rural Health Analysis. He says Fayette County mirrors parts of Appalachia, where mining continues to disappear.
As job opportunity is lost within a community, it really creates an environment that is ripe for things like drug addiction and overdose.
He says so-called deaths of despair, overdose, suicide, and alcohol-related liver disease are likely intertwined. Don Kelso, the director of the Indiana Rural Health Association, has seen people with the same problem.
They just don't see any hope. They don't see any way out. I hear some of the same stories as I did when I was just a kid growing up in the 60s from some of the inner city things. You say, how do you get out of this cycle? And I'm seeing that now in some of the rural communities. It's very, very same.
Mental health services can help ward off that despair, but Kelso says there sometimes aren't a lot of treatment options in rural areas. And sometimes people may hesitate at getting help.
People are sometimes reluctant to go to a mental health provider because somebody will see your car there. Oh, look, Don must be having mental problems, you know.
One group trying to combat this is End Stigma. It's hard to miss their billboards all over Connersville. The group receives state funding to address the stigma of substance abuse. But organizer and county counselor Holly Dunn says mental health is part of the same fight.
The correlation is huge. If you have mental illness, you are at a greater risk to also develop a substance use disorder.
End Stigma tries to reach people at block parties, back-to-school events, and on social media. Marcia Day is also working to address stigma.
Mental health and suicide are taboo. They see it as in the movie of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Clockwork Orange.
Day raises money and awareness for suicide prevention and founded Ryan's Hope Ministries.